Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In Hollywood movies, artificial intelligence cyborgs turn on their creators. We're not there yet. It's easy to trip up Siri. But that doesn't mean that artificial intelligence won't be a bigger force in the future. And if we are not careful, a threat. Tesla and SpaceX founder Elon Musk and others are funding an effort to design against that threat. The MIT scientist heading the push is with me today. This hour on Point, the potential threats posed by artificial intelligence and efforts now to avert problems in the future. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you embrace a world of super intelligent computers, a life, a world running on AI? Do you see the risks? How would you rein them in? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Go to the movies. It's almost always a problem. This year it was Ex Machina. Caleb Smith, played by Donald Gleason, is a programmer chosen to evaluate the artificial intelligence creation Ava, created by tech giant CEO of the world's most popular search engine, Nathan Bateman, played by Oscar Isaac. And pretty soon they're talking about artificial intelligence entities looking back on us, on humans, as skeletons and Neanderthals.
One day the AIs are going to look back on us the same way we look at fossil skeletons in the plains of Africa. An upright ape living in dust with crude language and tools, all set for extinction.
I am become death, the destroyer of worlds.
There you go again, Mr. Quotable.
There you go again. It's not my quote. It's what Oppenheimer said after he made the atomic bomb.
Yeah, I know what it is, dude.
Yeah, the atomic bomb and Oppenheimer. Of course, Elon Musk saying artificial intelligence may be more dangerous than nuclear weapons. Here was Musk, and of course, this is the founder of Tesla, SpaceX. He was speaking at MIT last October. Here he is talking about, well, the care humans need to take with artificial intelligence. Elon Musk.
I think we should be very careful about artificial intelligence. If I were to guess at what our biggest existential threat is, it's probably that. So we need to be very careful with artificial intelligence. I'm increasingly inclined to think that there should be some regulatory oversight, maybe at the national and international level, just to make sure that we don't do something very foolish. With artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
With artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon. Elon Musk there. And it's not only him. Stephen Hawking making some very rather dire predictions about humanity and artificial intelligence. Bill Gates expressing concern recently, saying he doesn't understand why people are not concerned about the super intelligent machines, and on and on. Elon Musk has given $10 million to the Future of Life Institute at MIT to look into ways to guard against AI getting out of control. With me right now, the professor, the scientist who heads that effort, Max Tegmark, professor of physics at MIT, co-founder of the Future of Life Institute, research organization focused on addressing risks from artificial intelligence. Max Tegmark, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
All these super human minds speaking up to say that we are at risk. When Elon Musk says with AI we are summoning the demon, what does he mean?
It's really funny how the media tend to always focus on the negative.
Excuse me, this is Elon Musk talking at your institution saying on microphone we're summoning the demon. Yeah. I don't think it's focusing on the negative. We're quoting your funder.
Oh, I was in the audience in the front row. Absolutely. And what he's saying is this technology has the potential to become the most powerful technology ever. If you go back a bit, you know, we humans had basically no tech. Then we invented during the Industrial Revolution technology that gradually could replace our muscle work. Mm-hmm. So we focused on brain work. Now we're inventing technologies that can instead start replacing also what our brains do. So it's obvious that this has the potential to be a game changer and the ultimately perhaps most powerful tech ever. Because if this succeeds, this quest to make machines that are smarter than us, then that's the last invention we have to make, because it can help us then make discoveries of all the other technologies. So why do people worry about this? I'm a pretty cheerful guy, and we decided to call our organization the Future of Life Institute rather than the Future of Death, Doom, and Gloom Institute, right? Because we feel that technology has an enormous power for good. Every single way in which 2015 is better than the Stone Age is because of technology, and my university even has the word tech in its name. But we have to remember at the same time that, of course, powerful tech is always a double-edged sword. And it's the crucial thing to me is to always make sure we win this race that we have between the growing power of tech and the growing wisdom with which we manage the tech. If you look at a not very powerful technology like the invention of fire, we screwed up a bunch of times, then we learned from our mistakes, invented the fire extinguisher, and all was good. But with more powerful technologies like nuclear weapons, like synthetic biology, and future, perhaps superhuman AI, we don't want to learn from our mistakes. We obviously want to get things right the first time, because it might be the only time we have.
You know, you talk about technologies replacing muscle power and superintelligent computers, artificial intelligence replacing not muscles, but what our brains do. What our brains do is what I guess has given us dominion over the planet, for better or worse, but at least it's ours. We are the devil we know, in a way. If computers replace that, who's in charge, and why don't they just replace us?
Yeah, that is a very profound question you're asking, which we should all be discussing rather than just sort of bumbling into this sort of situation. Because the reason, of course, that we humans have dominion over this planet, why we have more power than the tigers, is not that we have bigger muscles than the tigers or sharper claws. It's that we are smarter than the tigers. And if we one day create machines that are smarter than us, there's absolutely no guarantee that we're going to remain in control. Some people think that nonetheless wouldn't be so bad. But in that case, if we ultimately cede control, it's crucial that whatever we cede control to has the same goals that we do, that have goals aligned to us. I think the most dangerous thing that we see with the Terminator movies and other stuff coming out of Hollywood is not the risks they portray, which are usually completely off base and more of a distraction, but rather that they distract us from what the actual risks are, which have basically nothing to do with robots turning evil and so on. We shouldn't be afraid of machines turning evil. That's just silly anthropomorphization. Mm-hmm. What we should be afraid of is machines turning extremely competent and having different goals in us. When we cause trouble for species that are dumber than us, like when we kill ants, for example, it's not because we're evil and have any vendetta against the ants, obviously. But if they're in your living room, you know, maybe you don't want
you don't
have
like
another
it.
Goal. And if I put you in charge of this awesome green energy project to build a fantastic hydroelectric dam, you know, and just as you're going to turn the water on, you see there's an anthill in the middle, you know, what are you going to do?
I'm going to turn it on.
Tough luck for the ants. And it's not because you're an evil ant hater. Mm-hmm. This has nothing to do with evil. It's simply the fact that your goals weren't quite aligned with the goals of the ants, and you were smarter than the ants. So what I love about a lot of these research projects that got funded here is that they're actually studying how you can make machines learn what we humans want, what our goals actually are, so that they can actually help us achieve our goals rather than pursue very, very different goals. And it's interesting to think a little bit about how hard it is to actually understand what other people want. If you, for example, have some future very intelligent self-driving car and you say, take me to Logan Airport as fast as possible.
I don't mean run over everything in the way and blow through every red light.
Yeah, and you'd get there chased by police helicopters covered in vomit. Then you'd be like, this isn't what I asked for. And the car would be like, this is exactly what you asked for.
As fast as possible.
So we don't want machines to actually do what we tell them to do. We want them to do what we meant. And this is a very old story. You see it in a lot of myths and even in the King Midas story, right? He wished that everything he touched would turn to gold. It seemed like a cool idea at the time until he touched his dinner and couldn't eat it and then hugged his daughter and oopsie. And
she was gold too and everything went right. But it's hard to imagine if, and we'll talk more about this, but if we are going to be surpassed in intelligence by the machines around us, that we can do exactly what you're setting out to do, which is kind of set parameters in advance. Why would the superintelligence obey the parameters laid out by, if we are indeed one day a lesser intelligence, why don't they just go on to develop their own priorities?
Those are very interesting questions, and the obvious truth is we don't have answers to them now. The good news is we probably don't need answers to them for at least a few decades because we're not talking about risks tomorrow or next year here. But since these questions are so hard and it might take decades to figure out the answers, we should get started now on the research. And that's why I'm so excited that all these teams around the world are starting now just to go in the right direction and begin to ask these questions.
With funding from Elon Musk and others, you've put out something like $7 million worth of grants. We're going to talk with a couple of the leaders of two of those projects in the course of this hour as we look at AI and where it's headed. What's the idea? Do you think you can lay out a blueprint that will contain it or somehow design it from the get-go so that it stays within the realm of human desire?
The ultimate goal is, of course, very ambitious, is to figure out a way of helping AI amplify our intelligence for good. But the immediate goal is much more modest. It's simply to say, let's take some steps in the right direction and get this fantastic community of AI researchers actually thinking seriously about this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about making artificial intelligence, AI, work for, not against, humanity, and a new initiative to design AI controls and characteristics for the better. Max Tegmark is with me in the studio, co-founder of the Future of Life Institute. He's professor of physics at MIT. Elon Musk, founder of Tesla, SpaceX, and more, has put down $10 million here. And they are funding projects, research projects around the world to try and get humanity's arms around AI before maybe it gets its arms all around us. Of course, every time Hollywood gets its hands on this, it's pretty much a nightmare. Last year, Transcendence came out. AI scientist Dr. Will Castor, played by Johnny Depp, is killed by an anti-technology extremist, but his wife and fellow researcher Evelyn, Rebecca Hall, succeed in uploading his mind. In his new incarnation, Castor wants power. Hear from the trailer.
You need to get me online. I need more power.
It may be intelligent. It may even be sentient. This is not well.
Shut it down.
Shut it down? It's him!
Your friend crossed the line. They don't know the danger.
This is astounding.
So how do we fight it?
You can't. An AI is like any intelligence. It has needs.
Intelligence. It has needs. Max Tegmark is with me in the studio. Max, that's Hollywood. But let's listen to Stephen Hawking. People have a lot of respect for him. He's a physicist like yourself. Mm-hmm. He says, one can imagine, he's talking about artificial intelligence, superintelligent computers, one can imagine such technology, he wrote last year, outsmarting financial markets, out-inventing human researchers, out-manipulating human leaders, and developing weapons we cannot even understand. Whereas the short-term impact of AI depends on who controls it, Stephen Hawking writes, the long-term impact depends on whether it can be controlled at all. I guess the premise of your work at the Future of Life Institute is that it can. So how do we put out, I don't know, buffers, guidelines, tracks that this might stay on in the future?
That's a great question. And in fact, statement that you just read there, that's actually from a letter I wrote together with Stephen Hawking and Frank Wilczek and also Stuart Russell, who is one of the leaders of the AI field and wrote the textbook that most other researchers have learned it from. Mm-hmm. So it's a very interesting set of questions. We are not pretending to have the answers now. We feel, hey, let's just really pay attention to this and study it. It's not clear that what we even want is to just control AI. You know, if you have a very intelligent employee in your company, and you just lock them in a cage and force them to do things they don't want, maybe it'll work in the short term, but it doesn't feel like a particularly ethical solution, and it also is going to always motivate them to break out and thwart you, right? Much better would be if you can work with your employee or the AI and have shared goals, so you're all trying to accomplish the same thing together.
Maybe you're right, but would Neanderthals agree with this? They sort of made way for Homo sapien, and they're gone.
Yeah, it didn't work out so well for them. So this is the reason why we should think this through carefully long before we get there, to make sure that things actually pan out the way they do. And I feel that this is actually emerging as the most important conversation of our time, because it really calls into question the whole issue of what it means to be human and what sort of future we actually want. I think there's a huge potential upside, because everything that I love about civilization is the product of intelligence, of course. So if we can amplify our own human intelligence with the help of machines, there is an enormous potential for making things be better, curing diseases and inventing pretty much whatever technology is possible according to the laws of physics, which is almost everything we can imagine. As long as we plan ahead, though, and make sure that we do this well.
Plan ahead sounds very mild. The more I read here, the more interesting the title of your institute became to me, the Future of Life Institute. Isn't there some question, if you have super intelligent computers, of whether life is even necessary to a computer's mind? For humans, necessary. We have to eat. We are biological. Computers are not. All they need is energy and, I suppose, carbon to play with if they want to be amused. They don't need life. Are those the stakes here?
The stakes are big. Yeah, as a physicist, of course, I look at you as a big blob of quarks and electrons. No offense. They're arranged in a very fantastically elaborate pattern.
Oh,
yeah. You know.
Oh, do go on.
But your brain is the most beautifully complex quark pattern in the known universe.
Yeah, right.
And so are all our listeners. But at the same time, there's absolutely no law of physics saying that you can't make quark blobs that are even better at solving problems and figuring stuff out. So to me, as a physicist, it would be very naive to think that we are the pinnacle of what's possible. After 13.8 billion years, somehow, you know, progress has ended in our universe with us.
But we're the measure of what's possible, at least by our own yardstick. I mean, what's the point? What's the point of an intelligence or existence, maybe life's even the wrong word, beyond ours?
Yeah, though, what really AI and the great progress in AI in the last 5 years, I feel, has done is it's taken all these beautiful questions from philosophy, which had become increasingly ignored by a lot of tech people, and brought them right back into the forefront. We have to ask, what kind of future do we really want for life, for our cosmos? Because only when we can articulate our goals, of course, do we have a decent chance to get there. I think I like to compare the human strategy with when students walk into my office here across the river at MIT and ask for career advice. If I have a student coming and I ask them, hey, how do you envision success in your life? And they say, well, I think maybe in 20 years I might get cancer and maybe I'll get hit by a bus and become unemployed. And that's the terrible strategy for career planning. What I want them to come in and say is, with fire in their eyes, like, this is my goal. I want to be there and do this. And then you can think about the pitfalls to avoid and figure out strategies for how to get there. But we humans, we do kind of the opposite. When we visualize the future through Hollywood movies, it's always almost dystopias. We just obsess about all the things that can go wrong, instead of even trying hard to visualize what kind of future of life we would really want. And we want to encourage with our organization that kind of positive, goal-oriented thinking, and that's why we picked the name, the Future of Life Institute.
Let's see how some of the steps toward that might be pursued. We are going to speak with a couple of people who have grants from the Future of Life Institute. This is from a pot of cash put down by Elon Musk and others, taking slices of the challenge here of making AI work for the better and not something else, making it work more effectively. For the first, I want to go to Hefei, China. Well, that's a name from the past. I've been in Hefei, but it's been many years ago. Anhui Province, Manuela Veloso joins us. Manuela is professor of computer science at Carnegie Mellon University. She received a $200,000 grant from the Future of Life Institute to research ways for robots to explain why they behave the way they do, AI explaining itself. Manuela Veloso, thank you very much for being with us from Hefei, China. Why is this capacity for AI to explain itself to us important?
Hi, yes, thanks for having me. So what happens is that AI, like Max very well said, is pursuing this goal of integrating capabilities. Like a robot is able to look at the scene with a camera, it's able to have some goals to achieve and make decisions about I'll turn left, I'll turn right, and eventually move. So there is this integrative aspect of intelligence in terms of putting perception, cognition, and action capabilities together. But what happens is that this type of like performance is within humans. And then if a human, a person, wants to ask, so why did you turn left there? Or why did you move more to the right? Mm-hmm. Or how many people did you find on your way here? So the data exists somehow in the robot, in pixels, in decisions at the numerical level. But the interaction with humans to actually query these machines and just ask simple questions like, why did you do that? Why did you turn that? Why did you choose to do this? What did you see? Are very hard yet in our algorithmic way of writing robots and machines to provide these explanations. So I think that's one way of getting machines to be more trustable by humans, if humans can relate to these machines and query them.
So give us an example, yeah, if you would, Manuel, an example or two. Let's say robots are out there in the world, and I don't know what they might be doing, and what kind of situation might humans want to say, hey, what's going on?
Yeah, so it's very concretely at Carnegie Mellon, we have deployed what we call service robots. They are mobile robots that wander around the corridors of Carnegie Mellon, 9 floors of our building, 350 offices, and they escort people from one place to another. They transport items like packages that came on the mail from one place to another, and they deliver messages. So they really move around in the building, and nobody chases them. Nobody goes behind seeing what's happening. Mm-hmm. So they have gone for more than 1,000 kilometers. This is the PhD thesis of 3 of my students, Joy Deep and Brian and Stephanie. And in some sense, it's true that my interaction with these cobots, these collaborative robots, goes through this phase of seeing them appearing in front of my office with a visitor, and then they go back to the lab. And at 3 p.m. when they come back, I tend to want to ask them, so what happened? Did you find many people? Was the visitor well escorted to this destination? So you want kind of like an understanding of what happened while you were not seeing this machine, or why the machine made some decisions. Why did you come late? Why are you moving so fast? Or something. And eventually it's hard, unless I go to a terminal and start programming the robot, to generate explanations or to generate or natural or understandable explanations of what made the actual robot make decisions about going left or going right, or coming up saying this thing, interacting. Why did you choose this sentence? It's not that we query humans as much, but machines appear in front of you and you have very little inference about what can they do, given that they look like metal with a computer on wheels and a camera. And you would like, and they are making decisions. They are like telling you, "Did you find my keys in my office?"
Yeah.
And you would like to say, if it says no, I would like to say, "Why not? Did you search?"
Yeah, Manuela, it's easy to understand the importance of this. I mean, you can imagine, especially if artificial intelligence grows, if computers are running many aspects of the world, we humans might like to know what's going on. Here's a question for you. Is programming them to explain their actions, is that consistent with efficiency? Or will it bog them down to the point that everybody's like, oh, never mind, it's too much trouble to have them explain?
Yeah, a very good question. That's one of the topics of this proposal that we put together, is to generate explanations at different level of abstraction. So the explanation is not a one-shot kind of problem. It's like, with what degree of detail do you want the explanation to come up? I mean, if it's going to tell us that it multiplied some two numbers and thresholded them by another number, it doesn't help me. So in some sense, it's a complicated process, this concept of explaining, the same way that if you ask a human, why did you diagnose me with cancer? The doctor may have a very deep explanation in its mind for the, in his mind for the actual conclusion or the output of whatever interaction we have. And he may have to relate with you at different level of abstraction. So we see this explanation generation as an iterative process. I might ask something, the robot, and something I might go, what do you mean by that? And then further down. And this is a process that we in AI understand, have pursued for a while, but don't understand in the depth that we may be able to further understand with the future of these research proposals and to try to make it trustable by humans and build these kind of better understanding of what these artificial creatures can help us with.
And let me ask you this, Manuela. How do you inculcate in the robot the priority or the willingness to explain, especially as artificial intelligence grows? I mean, think of a human analogy. The king may not... He may refuse to explain to his stable boy why he does what he does. You know, the boy who cleans out the stables, the king won't give him the time of day. He's not going to explain why he's invading Poland. What? Why are computers going to take the time to explain their actions to we meager human intelligences?
I think about myself a little bit more than meager intelligence.
Well, today, but tomorrow we may be dwarfed by their intelligence.
So let me just answer that just in a little bit, waving my hands in a philosophical way.
Okay.
In some sense, we are the people that created these creatures, and we are not only forecasting the future, but we have an ability to shape it. And that's a quote from Herb Simon in one of his last lectures, CMU, Herb Simon, Nobel Prize in Economics and founder of AI.
Yeah.
He said he gave a great talk on forecasting the future or shaping it. And in some sense, that's what these grants, that's what this research is trying to make us understand, is that we have to shape it in the right way. But inevitably, these machines will go in parallel with humanity. So while humans are shaping them, while humans are doing AI doesn't fall from the sky. AI is done by humans. And in some sense, humans need to shape it the right way and put it the right goals. And that's how I see the more philosophical view of the future, is in fact that this is going to be a coexistence challenge, which is we cannot deny, we cannot stop these computers. I mean, our GPS that generate routes for us, and we trust them. Google Maps say, go here, go there, go there, and we do it. I mean, it's AI is here. I mean, it's not something of the future only. And we have been building trust on all these AI features and capabilities. We just have to move forward and continue more and more putting these as one of our priorities. Like Max really said so well, that it's bringing this discussion more to the front as capabilities augment in these systems.
Manuela Veloso, you are terrific. Out of Carnegie Mellon University with a $200,000 grant from the Future of Life Institute, joining us miraculously today from Hefei, China. Thank you so much, Manuela.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Max Tegmark, just a minute before the break here, how do you see the importance of this particular project, developing AI that is capable and ready to explain itself to humans?
I think it's a wonderful and necessary step towards a positive outcome, because the only way you're going to really trust AI systems is if you feel you have a deeper understanding of what they're doing and why they're doing. And I want to agree with Manuela's optimism there. You know, we should not think of arrival of superhuman AI, if it happens in, say, 50 years or whatever, as equivalent to aliens sending us an email, hey, we're going to arrive in 50 years and our technology is way beyond you. That would be beyond our control. Here, instead, we're talking about the possible arrival of something where we actually, as humans, get to shape it. We are the masters of our own destiny.
At the beginning.
Exactly.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about making artificial intelligence work for, not against, humanity, a new initiative to design AI controls and characteristics for the better. Co-founder of the Future of Life Institute, Max Tegmark, is with me today, professor of physics at MIT. Elon Musk, founder of Tesla, SpaceX, and more, has put down $10 million, and they have a lot of grants going out to help researchers think about what it will take to line A up in a good way to work with, we hope, humans long-term as it becomes more and more powerful. You can join the conversation this hour. What do you think? Is Elon Musk right? Are we, with artificial intelligence, summoning the demon facing our biggest existential threat? Tom Dietrich joins us in just a moment, president of the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence. But first, a couple of calls. Anne in Burlington, Vermont. Thanks for calling, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Huh? I have yelled at Siri more than once for misinterpreting what I'm asking for. I love language. I love poetry. I love metaphor and allusion and so on. What happens to literature? What happens to our abilities as humans to interpret what, as this wonderful technological progress advances, the human shrinks, I think. And I worry about literature, interpretation, goals, how do we define ourselves?
And you put your finger right on one of my sore spots, and I'm glad you raise it just that way. Max Tegmark, how about it? I mean, if we have machines saying, you know, don't speak to me with all that alliterative language or all that, don't make these allusions, I don't understand. I think Anne's right. So many of our commercial interactions today are done over a telephone with a kind of AI representative on the other end that's no longer human. And we humans are forced to sort of march or dance or speak to their tune, talk to Siri in a way that she can understand. Already nuance is being ironed out. Is this the future, or does somehow AI advance to the point where it becomes just as literary as Anne?
I think Anne makes a wonderful point. We obviously want to adapt the technology to us rather than adapt us to the technology.
What are the odds of that being the way things turn out?
Well, that's really up to us to decide, because by default, if we don't pay attention, we've seen all these examples of where things don't necessarily turn out the way they want. That's why I feel that having this kind of conversation that Anne is raising is so crucial.
I think we're doomed then, because business doesn't care. They'll put me on the phone for 20 minutes with some idiot machine and they don't give a hoot.
But if someone else can develop a much better AI system which treats you with dignity and lets you and adapts to you, maybe you'll use that business instead.
True. Anne, I hope that's a little bit comforting. Carol in Goose Creek, South Carolina. Carol, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My name is Dr. Carol Seuss.
Yes.
And I'm an archaeologist, and I also work in the home health field.
Okay.
Now, one of the things that wasn't mentioned is the three laws of robotics. You see, as a person who has studied the past and works currently in the future, AI can be of great benefit because people who are blind, they have machines that read their prescriptions, or you have computers that can help communicate with the world. But people that are, like you said, some of the films, they're always destructive. But if you apply the three law of robotics and put it to assist level, no, it's not going to replace people. But you just have to know where the boundary is.
What are the three laws of robotics? What are we talking about here, Carolyn? Who came up with them?
Isaac Asimov came up with the three laws of robotics.
And they are?
Have you ever read the... one is you can do no harm to no one. Two, the other law of robotics is always do as you're directed. If you ever watched the show iRobot or read the book, law number three is you all has to do with humanity, but it's called the Three Laws of Robotics. And you haven't mentioned that issue once.
I think those three laws, I've got them here. A robot may not injure, a robot must obey orders given by human beings, and a robot must protect its own existence as long as it doesn't conflict with the first and second laws. Okay, we're way out there. Carol, I appreciate. Let me ask you one more thing. You're an archaeologist. 100,000 years from now, are we humans looked back on as a blip and the superintelligence runs the world?
It depends on how far we let technology grow.
Yeah.
Well, if we do it to us. Yeah, but the thing of it is, you build technology to assist, not to be controlling us. That's what people don't help to assist, but don't let it be the mainstream.
If we're smart enough to hold that line, we'll see. Max, what do you think of Isaac Asimov's three laws here? Are they consequential for you now?
I'm very glad they came up. This is a wonderful example of the kind of thinking we want to engage in. Of course, we should remember that most of Asimov's stories about the three laws of robotics are about how they go wrong in unexpected ways.
Right.
And so it's pretty obvious that his three laws of robotics alone are not going to cut it. But what a lot of the research we're funding is doing is actually looking for more sophisticated generalizations of the three laws and saying, how can we actually get AI to be beneficial in ways that actually work.
I want to bring in another one of your grant recipients, Thomas Dietrich. Tom Dietrich, he's with us from Portland, Oregon. I was just out in Oregon last week. President of the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence, Professor of Computer Science at Oregon State University. Also director there of the Intelligent Systems Research at the School of Electrical Engineering, Computer Science. He's got a grant from the Future of Life Institute to research ways for AI to be more careful and ask humans for help. Tom Dietrich in Portland, Oregon, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello.
Why is it important to instill a more risk aversion in artificial intelligence?
Well, I think if you look at some of the storylines like The Sorcerer's Apprentice, Mickey Mouse or whoever asks the brooms to bring water to put out the fire,
yeah,
and they just keep bringing water forever and ever.
They drown the place.
Yes, part of the problem is that they didn't have enough appreciation of their own ignorance, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a problem with the tradition in computational decision making has been basically that the computer assumed that it knew all of the relevant facts. Or if it didn't know them exactly, it could at least assess the probabilities of facts. But I think our former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld really articulated an important point, which is that we must be prepared for the unknown unknowns and take that into account in our actions. So let's say, for example, that Google trains their self-driving cars in North America, and they learn to recognize whether there's a squirrel running across the road or a child, or maybe it's just a paper bag being blown by the wind. And it learns that if it's a paper bag, it's okay to you don't have to brake for paper bags.
Okay.
And now we take that, and if you use the sort of current state of the art in computer vision and object recognition, the computer tends to assume that these are the only things that are there in the universe.
Whatever
it was, babies, bicycles, paper
mm-hmm.
bags, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's suppose we take that car and sell it in Australia. What does it do the first time a kangaroo jumps in front of the car?
I have no idea. What does it do?
Yeah. Well, at least the computer systems that I've worked with would try to figure out, is that a paper bag, a baby, or a bicycle, or a squirrel? And it would choose one of those things.
If it chooses paper bag, it's going to blow right through it, and you've got one dead kangaroo.
Yeah. So the idea here is to give the right programs that think about the unknown unknowns, the possibility that there's something out there that they've never seen before. And so in addition to recognizing objects that are familiar, they need to have some sort of a novelty or anomaly detection capability. So when they see something that's pretty different from anything they've seen before, they should take some conservative action instead.
How big a challenge is it?
Pulling over to the side of the road.
How big a challenge is it to deeply instill that into an artificial intelligence, that caution?
Well, we believe that it can be done. There's been a fair amount of work on anomaly detection in statistics and in artificial intelligence. And so our research is going to be integrating those techniques for anomaly detection and perhaps improving them into systems for object recognition and for decision making.
Max's group is called the Future of Life Institute. That has a kind of warm and fuzzy biological sound to it. Yours is called the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence. If you look out there and figure out that, whoops, in fact, we're not going to be able to fully control this, it will outstrip us and maybe make us irrelevant, maybe finish us off, will you tell us, Tom?
Well, the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence has two missions. One is you know, promoting the scientific study of artificial intelligence, and the other is promoting its responsible use. And so we would certainly, we are extremely concerned about its responsible use, enough to, this has been in our mission statement for many years.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, many of the things you've said on the show, I think attribute too much kind of independent will to artificial intelligence systems. I mean, we build them and instill them with a set of goals. They might be somewhat like the three laws of robotics, although we suspect it's more like the 30,000 laws of robotics.
Okay.
Right, because there are lots of nuances there that computers will have to learn. And I know Max is funding some other research that really is focusing on specifically on those questions of giving computers the ability to judge whether a certain action would be considered ethically appropriate by most people.
You know, fair enough. I mean, we don't want to be driven by Hollywood, and I hope we're not here. But we do pay attention when Stephen Hawking says the long-term impact depends on whether AI can be controlled at all, and raises that question. When Elon Musk calls AI our biggest existential threat, those phrases, not from Hollywood directors, get our attention. Christina in Cleveland, Ohio. Christina, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call, and you have a wonderful program. Yeah, I'm a philosophy professor, and I make documentaries on social issues like racism, class difference, and child abuse.
Okay. Okay.
And at the end of the day, we know that, you know, things like Plato's Symposium, you cannot program love because we don't even know what love is as human beings. We want it. We need it to survive. But we can't define it. And so my question, of course, I have friends who are roboticists at Carnegie Mellon and the like, and my question has always been, please tell me, first, what the definition of love may be. It's the most Googled word in history. And how do you program, philosophically speaking, and, you know, consciousness extended? We don't even have a definition of consciousness yet. We can all agree on.
Mm-hmm.
How do you program love into a robot? Because it's at the core of our social problems. It's at the core of racism, sexism, class difference. We need to, child abuse is an epidemic. Child sex abuse is an epidemic in this world, in this country. How do we program love into this?
Christina, let us pick it up. Philosopher Christina. All right, Max, we're looking at making AI compatible with human beings, Christina raises love. Have you made a grant here to research how to inculcate love into AI?
I think Tom has a response to this.
Tom Dietrich?
I mean, my sense is that we should make a very clear distinction between robotic artificial intelligence and humans. I don't think it's appropriate to talk about a robot loving anything. I mean, a robot can be taught to be honest, to treat everybody equally.
What about even
values,
recognizing
but
love?
A relationship between people.
But if one day AI runs the world and does not recognize love,
AI will we will not let AI run the world. AI is to be our slave. It's a technology that should be used to enhance our humanity. Not
Stephen Hawking's not so sure, and Max Tegmark says it might be cruel to keep it in a cage.
I disagree with Max on that. I don't think that there's a machine. It's fine to be cruel to a machine.
Is it fine to be cruel to an intelligence?
I want to defend
the
Tom here.
Even to a machine, I think. Right. I mean, you know, it's fine to be cruel to your phone right now, even though it's somewhat intelligent.
Max?
Right? It's not. It's just a confusion of categories to think about cruelty with respect to a machine.
A confusion of categories, I grant you, until that intelligence becomes very great. It may be very confusing. Max?
Well, I want to defend Tom Dietrich here, because I think it's very important to remember that intelligence, if you're an AI researcher, does not have anything to do with good, bad, evil, cruel. Intelligence is basically a synonym for great competence. You're just really good at accomplishing a goal, whatever it is. So if Tom builds a chess computer that's intelligent, it means it's really good at winning chess. But there's another kind of tournament some chess buffs have called losing chess, where you actually try to lose a game. And Tom could make a program that's really good at losing, too.
Yeah, but what if it's competence at running the world? Yeah. Stephen Hawking says they may outmanipulate human leaders.
Exactly. So this is where I'm getting. Mm-hmm. Tom and I agree on is we obviously want to make machines that are not just intelligent, but that have goals put into them that are aligned with our goals, then so that they don't want to do things that we view as terrible, and then they're not going to feel they're being treated in a cruel way either if they're actually doing what their goals are, which is the closest for a computer to doing, you know, what it wants to do.
Our own goals seem a bit suspect sometimes when you look at the planet. They're not all working out perfectly. What's to keep computers from assessing our goals and deciding that, they're not really what we ought to be following?
You make a good point. Well, we have to be humble also and realize that we humans ourselves are doing a lot of really dumb things. And one of the things AI would probably give us some pointers about is how we ourselves can get our act together better and not mess up our planet in various ways. Because somehow we our brains haven't quite managed to capture the full complexity of the world we're in, and we're driving all these species to extinction. And
there's a hopeful note for us to end on today. As these projects go forward, I hope, Max Tegmark, you'll come back and talk to us about how this is all unfolding. And same to you, Tom Dietrich, at the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence and Oregon State University. Max Tegmark, co-founder of the Future of Life Institute, professor of physics at MIT. Tom, thank you very much. And Max, with me right here in the studio, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me. I personally am quite optimistic that if we focus on these questions now, AI will be a force for good.
Here we go. Brave New World.